ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 11th of November. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. 50 years ago today, the Governor-General, Sir John Kerr, sacked Prime Minister Gough Whitlam. It was an unprecedented event. During a speech last night at Old Parliament House, where the political drama played out, the current PM, Anthony Albanese, said the sacking was driven by a brutal thirst for power.
While the scenes in this building on November 11 may have been chaotic, the dismissal was a calculated plot hatched by Conservative forces which sacrificed conventions and institutions in the pursuit of power. And the result of the election that followed does not wash away any of that.
The dismissal divided many Australians and ultimately led to Liberal leader Malcolm Fraser winning the following federal election. And after all these years, the question is, could it happen again? Nick Grimm takes us back 50 years, starting with this program, foreshadowing the events to come.
It was a morning like today, exactly 50 years ago.
Very good morning to you. Bill Dowsett with AM for Tuesday, the 11th of November. And what a day of anniversaries today is. It's Remembrance Day. It's also...
Even then, it seemed November the 11th would be remembered for more than Remembrance Day, more than the anniversary of a declaration of independence in then white minority ruled Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and more than the creation of the newly independent African state of Angola. Here, other events of great moment were about to unfold.
On which there could be some end to our own constitutional deadlock. Just about an hour from now, they'll be meeting in the Prime Minister's suite in Parliament House. Mr. Whitlam and Mr. Fraser, both publicly, it seems, committed to intransigence.
As AM went to air that morning, both leaders had already arrived at the steps of the building now known as Old Parliament House. Prime Minister Gough Whitlam flippant with the awaiting media as his destiny loomed.
Never seen you fellas up so early.
While opposition leader Malcolm Fraser couldn't resist giving journalists a tease of his own.
Do you seriously expect Mr. Whitlam to give ground on this today?
Well, we'll find out, won't we?
So it started off like any other day in a crisis, then ended up as something extraordinary.
Political journalist Nikki Savva was at Parliament House that day to watch events unfold, triggered when the opposition used its numbers in the Senate to block the Labor government's budget in a bid to force a new election.
People were expecting that the crisis would have to be resolved one way or another, but nobody, including Whitlam, knew how it would be resolved that day, which was the most dramatic, most exciting, and I guess in many ways most traumatic day in federal politics.
But as Gough Whitlam prepared to call a half-Senate election, the then Governor-General Sir John Kerr instead moved first, breaking the political stalemate by sacking the Prime Minister of the day. As the news spread, crowds formed on the steps of Parliament.
It took some time for word to filter out that the Prime Minister had been sacked by the Governor-General. A lot of people had heard about it in the public service buildings close to Parliament House. A lot of schools, a lot of teachers had heard, who told students, and many of them just flooded to the building. It was, you know, the most spine-tingling scene.
Then, as a proclamation for the dissolution of the Parliament was read out, Gough Whitlam himself emerged and spoke the most famous words of Australian politics.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
They were scenes the like of which Australians had never witnessed before or since. Also there that day, a young TV entertainer, Gary McDonald, pioneering what would become the genre of vigilante political satire through his character Norman Gunston.
What I want to know, is this an affront to the constitution of this country? Or was it just a stroke of good luck for Mr. Fraser?
Thanks very much. Just wanted
to... The young political journo, Nikki Savas, saw Norman Gunston's presence was extraordinary all in itself and set about interviewing the celebrity interviewer.
It was a pretty weird and wonderful day. When I was interviewing him, he would speak to me and he was Gary McDonald, right? Like speaking like a normal person, like you and I are speaking now. And then someone would come up to him and say, Norman, Norman. And then he would speak to them as Norman Gunston. So it was very disconcerting.
I congratulate the Liberal and National Country parties.
Ultimately, Gough Whitlam would go on to lose the next federal election, while Coalition leader Malcolm Fraser would serve 7 years as Prime Minister until Labor regained power in 1983.
Yeah, look, they were political disruptors. There'd never been a Prime Minister and an opposition like them before.
Troy Bramston is a senior writer with the Australian newspaper and author of a new biography of Gough Whitlam. And while he believes another dismissal of a serving government remains a theoretical possibility, he argues the combination of the three forceful personalities that drove events half a century ago is unlikely to ever be replicated.
And I don't think we've ever had politicians like them before. These are really big, gigantic, enormous, vivid, character-drawn figures, you know, who do linger in our memory. And I think there's a recognition among parliamentarians, the High Court, and subsequent governors general that this shouldn't have happened the way it did, and it probably won't happen again.
Troy Bramston is a senior writer for the Australian newspaper. Nick Grimm, our reporter there. The Federal Liberal Party meets in Canberra tomorrow to decide whether to keep the net zero carbon emissions policy. Many MPs say the party should junk it, arguing that's what grassroots members want. But analysis of the largest voting bloc in Australia shows that ditching the policy might put the party out of touch. Federal political reporter Isabella Tolhurst explains.
Australia's largest voting bloc is made up of millennials and Gen Z, or people born between 1981 and 2013. And the investigator for the Australian Elections Study, Simon Jackman, says they're favouring Labor and the Greens at levels not seen in the study's 38-year history. He says climate was among their top issues.
It is now a mainstream position to be ambitious on climate change and on energy transitions. The odd position out here is to think that net zero is overly ambitious.
While people generally tend to vote more conservatively as they get older, the 2025 study of more than 2,000 people shows millennials are bucking the trend. Their support of the coalition fell to 21%. And Mr. Jackman, who's an honorary professor at the University of Sydney, says there's only one pathway if the Liberals ever hope to return to government.
A big call has to be made on the sort of party they want to be. And that means, I think, putting to bed any doubts younger Australians might have about their commitment to climate change.
The coalition only won 10% of first preferences among people who named climate change as a top priority. On the streets of Adelaide, these young people agree the environment influenced their vote.
It does play a part in it because, you know, we need to be able to live in the world. And if there's no world to live in, then we're screwed, obviously.
It is important to me what my MPs believe about it and how much funding they're putting towards certain policies.
The Liberal Party is meeting this week to come to its final position on net zero emissions by the year 2050. There's growing speculation the Liberals will follow in the Nationals' footsteps and dump the policy. Flinders political science professor Intiva Chowdhury says as the younger voter base balloons, climate inaction could spell electoral disaster.
They do risk permanent opposition, and the reason being, if you look at the seats that the Liberal Party lost, are overwhelmingly urban seats. Younger voters have abandoned the Liberal Party in droves. There is a risk of further alienating the voters.
But she notes voters' top priorities can change, with cost of living pressures increasingly prominent. Professor Chowdhury says young voters tend not to have party loyalties, which has seen the Liberals lose seats to independents and Teals.
I think this poses a huge challenge to actually think about the issues that are important to voters and how that changes from election to election, because they absolutely cannot bank on ideological loyalty.
Mr. Jackman says it will make for difficult conversations in the Liberal Party room this week.
This raises profound questions of identity. It means saying to some of the respected elders that the set of ideas you have about this issue are no longer fit for purpose.
The Australian Election Study, Simon Jackman, ending Isabella Tolhurst's report. Donald Trump says he'll sue the BBC for $1 billion unless the public broadcaster retracts statements in a controversial documentary about the US president. Both the corporation's director general and chief executive of news have resigned over it amid allegations the British public broadcaster's biased. Elias Kluwer reports.
Here we go.
As BBC CEO of News Deborah Turnus returned to work on Monday, a media pack was waiting.
I'd like to say it has been the privilege of my career to serve as the CEO of BBC News and to work with our brilliant team of journalists.
They're demanding answers over allegations the British public broadcaster misled viewers and deliberately mischaracterised the contents of a speech made by US President Donald Trump.
Why did you fail to deal with the mistakes
that were made?
And see my teams. Thank you so much.
Right, we're going now.
Do you think that the journalists are corrupt, Mike?
Panorama, the BBC's flagship current affairs programme, aired a documentary just days out from the 2024 US presidential election. And in it was this clip of a speech made by Mr. Trump on the 6th of January, 2021.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol, and I'll be there with you, and we fight. We fight like hell.
That clip, or grab, as it's known in TV journalism, were two separate statements said by Trump about 54 minutes apart. And the controversy also lies in what Panorama didn't show. This is the full statement, unedited.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol, and we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women.
An ex-BBC advisor, Michael Prescott, wrote in a dossier that was later leaked to the UK newspaper The Telegraph that the editing made it seem that President Trump explicitly incited the January 6 riots at the Capitol.
We have taken action. It ranges from all sorts of things, from issuing corrections when we got it wrong.
That's Samir Shah, the chair of the BBC, who has apologised for the incident.
Part of the problem is the way it was edited. Yeah. But what was the consequence of that? I think we just need to go into a bit more detail.
Deborah Turnus and Director General Tim Davey have both resigned amid the Trump Panorama controversy. But the mea culpa from senior BBC management wasn't enough to placate Donald Trump. A letter has been sent to the BBC on behalf of the US president demanding the, quote, defamatory statements be retracted by the 14th of November. Otherwise, Mr. Trump will sue the British broadcaster for $1 billion. Nigel Farage, the leader of the Populist Party Reform, accused the BBC of election interference.
The BBC has been institutionally biased for decades.
The BBC is funded by licensing fees paid for by UK households and is a British institution. As well as the Trump edit, the Prescott dossier criticised the BBC's coverage of transgender issues and raised concerns of anti-Israeli bias in the BBC's Arabic service. Amid the criticism, the British government says it still has faith in the BBC. A Downing Street spokesperson has said that the government does not believe that the broadcaster is institutionally biased. This is Elias Kluwer in London, reporting for AM.
It's not just the Barossa Shiraz that's bold in South Australia. The Business Council of Australia says South Australia is the best place to do business in the country, thanks to low regulation and taxation. But across the border, Victoria is ranked the worst. Angus Randall reports.
Dr. Harvey Law feels loyal to Victoria. He met his wife at Monash University, and together they built acoustic soundproofing business Megasorber from the ground up in the state. But he knows other businesses have moved away.
We love Victoria, got a really good education base, talent in the state. But if you look at some of the other companies we associate with, definitely I know already one of the companies moved to Queensland or Brisbane. Definitely is more attractive.
Victoria ranked last in the Business Council of Australia's annual assessment of regulations and tax policies for businesses across the country. Dr. Law says he's not surprised.
Even the small things like, you know, the payroll tax. To me, like, to employ more people, you get more tax. which is very discouraging.
The state has been stuck at the bottom of the rankings ever since the Business Council began assessing where it was easiest for businesses to operate 3 years ago. Its chief executive is Bran Black.
It's got a long way to go in some key areas where other states perform well, particularly in the context of business licensing, especially in the context of payroll tax, and also in the context of stamp duty and land tax as well.
A Victorian government spokesperson says the state has consistently had the strongest business investment in the country, and the government has cut or abolished taxes 65 times, including slashing payroll tax for small businesses and ditching business insurance duty. While it won't surprise anyone that the organisation representing the nation's largest companies supports lower tax and less regulation, the Business Council's Bran Black says these incentives drive productivity.
We know that there is a absolutely clear linkage between productivity and real wages growth, and that's ultimately how we drive living standards.
Across the border, he says South Australia has led the way over the past 3 years.
The states that do particularly well, like South Australia, are doing well in the areas of business licensing, so having less restrictive and less onerous licensing requirements, looking at areas like payroll tax and looking at taxes on land like stamp duty and land tax as well.
Andrew Kay is the CEO of the South Australian Business Chamber.
There certainly seems to be a buzz, a sense of optimism around our state at the moment.
He says the state is reaping the benefits of recent planning reform, but there are still challenges ahead.
The SMEs, or the small to medium businesses in South Australia, are struggling with the impact of a cost of doing business crisis in the midst of a cost of living crisis. So for those businesses, the challenges are still very real.
South Australian Business Chamber's Andrew Kay, Angus Randall reporting there. A mother arriving at her new home in Broome, leased through Western Australia's housing department, says she was devastated by what she found. Photos shared with the ABC show the house strewn with rubbish and used needles, while the inside was caked with dirt. The department says the property was vandalised before the tenancy started and wasn't like that when it was expected. Ruby Littler reports.
Having experienced homelessness for years, single mother of two, Amelia Johnson, says she was relieved when she secured a house in WA's far north. But she says that relief quickly vanished when she visited the home assigned to her in October by the WA Department of Housing and Works in Broome.
It was just shocking. Dirty needles and a syringe. And then the further I walked, the more disgusted I became.
Ms. Johnson also claims the property was not secure, with large gaps between the screen doors and windows. She deemed the house too unsafe to live in with her 11 and 12-year-old children, so she returned to Kununurra, 1,000 kilometres away, to couch surf with relatives instead.
Me and my children, we don't have our own little space. We don't have a safe place to put our head down at night. I've been couch surfing, going from family house to family house, and the harder I try to get good accommodation for us, it's just next to impossible.
Ms. Johnson says she feels as though the government has failed and ignored her in a time of crisis. WA Council of Social Services CEO Louise Gelito says it's never acceptable to lease out a house if it's unlivable.
You have Grow Housing, which is for public servants, which has minimum standards that includes, thermal controls, cooling, heating, fans, but they don't apply the same minimum standards for public housing, and we think and firmly believe they should be the same. Housing is a human right and minimum standards are really important.
Ms. Gelito says the Department of Housing and Works gets over 200,000 work orders for repair and maintenance annually. She said in the Kimberley and Pilbara, the problem was often getting the workforce to actually do those repairs.
And depending on the state of the building, I think they're making value judgments about do they let the property sit vacant or do they allow tenants to go in, because there's such high demand, as we know. There's over 20,000 people on the wait list, so they're in a bind at the moment.
In a statement, a Department of Housing and Works spokesperson said in this case, in between an inspection and when Ms. Johnson moved in, people have broken into the property and significantly vandalised the property, and that this was not the condition of the property when it was offered to Ms. Johnson. The statement also said that such incidents can occur on the private rental market, and the department is in regular contact with Ms. Johnson, who has been offered another three-bedroom home in Broome.
Ruby Littler reporting from Broome. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. 3 hours of free electricity in the middle of the day sounds pretty good. But is the federal government's latest solar offer going to reduce hefty power bills? Or is there a catch? Today, energy expert from the Grattan Institute, Alison Reeve, unpacks the ups and downs of the scheme. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.